Welcome to the latest edition of the Watercolors Aquarium Gallery podcast. My name is Ben. I'm the owner of the Watercolors Aquarium Gallery.
My name is Amy. I'm the retail manager of Watercolors, keeping track of inventory and making sure people get what they need.
And I'm Charles. I'm the assistant manager, but in actuality, I mostly work downstairs in quarantine.
In the mad scientist lab.
That too.
All right, so today we're going to be talking about everyone's favorite fish, the clownfish. Wait, if you're really geeky and techie, don't tune out. If you're tired of clownfish, don't tune out. We are going to go into some pretty deep, get into the meat of this topic a little bit. So we're going to do some pretty cool morphological and genealogical and all kinds of
I'm pretty excited to learn about some clownfish that I don't know about because really, for the most part, we're dealing mainly with the Oscillaris and the Perculas. We don't get the other ones in that much just because people aren't interested in them, so that's what we're trying to change.
I simultaneously think that clownfish as a group of organisms are the most overappreciated and most underappreciated marine fish.
Part of the inspiration for us doing this talk was we got a group of saddlebacks in, Amphiprion palimnus. We got a group of those saddlebacks in, and they're so cool as a group in our anemone tank, and that. You know, maybe that's something for the underappreciated saltwater list we're going to do here pretty soon.
Yeah.
No one gets to take that. That one's mine. So, clownfish, let's get into it. First, of course, we have to talk about clownfish because if you want to quantify something, is there a better saltwater aquarium fish?
Probably not.
In terms of suitability for being in an aquarium, I mean, you can't get better than the captive-raised clownfish we're getting. You can add them to a tank, and immediately they're out and begging. They're so hardy. They're so personable. I mean, there's a reason that they were chosen for that infamous movie that maybe we are naming them, maybe we aren't. But but it's just because they're just so fun.
Well, that and they just adapt to aquarium life so well because in the wild, most species would regulate themselves to like a meter square max.
We could go cubic on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So that makes them suitable for just about any aquarium that has some, unless it has something in it that will eat them. Although there are even some of the clownfish that could fit into a category of these guys can go with some pretty gnarly predators.
Mm-hmm.
There's clownfish for every category. There's clownfish for the people who want the super rare and unusual and hard to get. There's clownfish for the, I want to do as small of a tank as safe for clownfish. And you can do it and have clownfish be healthy and happy for their very, very long lifespan.
Yeah, even something like a 10-gallon is suitable for a pair of Oscillaris or Perculas.
Even skunks, I would do a pair of skunks in 10s. A lot of the breeders that I know breed all of those fish in 10 gallons. Their broodstock pairs are in 10 gallons. All right, so now that we've sung their praises, the meat of it, we're going to go with many of the species of smaller clownfish.
Mm-hmm.
Basic needs. 10-gallon minimum, but that's pushing it. Stay on top of your maintenance. A 20-gallon aquarium, I would say, is an easy size to do maybe a quarter of the species of clownfish, which, oh, by the way, include all of the fancy ones that are coming out as of late. Actually, we should talk about that for real quick.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to talk about care of clownfish and what kind of systems they should go in, for some of the beginners out there, we need to note that we're talking about cinnamon clowns versus skunk clowns versus pecula clowns, not onyx clowns or storms or Darwin or black, right? And the reason for that distinction is because everyone is calling the designer clowns, which will include the platinums and all those fancy ones, all of those are, with some new exceptions, sorry, most of those now are some form of either a pecula or an oscillaris or a combination of the two.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're talking about oscillaris and pecula care, all of those fancy types pretty much can go into that category.
Yeah. Right? For those of you who are less taxonomically inclined.
Well said.
We are talking about different species of clownfish. The fancy clowns we'd more refer to as breeds of clownfish. Is that how we want to put it?
I think that's a good term.
Ones that are the same species but look different. So that's different than when we're talking about a Nemo clown or a cinnamon clown, right?
Yeah.
Sure. So minimum carry, 20 gallons. Many different varieties of clowns you could do a pair of in a 20-gallon tank. Good water quality. Easy. I don't know how else to talk about it as being any easier than that.
Yeah.
How many reef tanks do we know out there that don't have a pair or a number of pairs of clownfish in there? I know of two.
And they're probably predator tanks.
No, two actual reef tanks that don't have clownfish in them. All I can think of, though.
Yeah?
Yeah. Predator tanks, of course, you got to be a little bit careful.
Right. And really, that's the fish that we often recommend as the first step.
Yes.
Because a lot of other reef fish, when they're going into a tank, their first instinct is, if I don't see any other fish out, I'm going to hide. Because on the reef, that means if nobody else is out, you probably shouldn't be either, because there's somebody out that's going to eat you.
Mm-hmm.
So the clownfish that we have, partially because they're captive raised and they don't quite have that same instinct as some of the wild caught fish we have, but also they're just so... they've been with humans their entire life, so they recognize us as a food source. They recognize us as something that's not a threat. So when you add them to the tank first, they're going to be out and about almost right away, whereas if you add a different fish, they might hide immediately, and if you have clowns in there, they'll draw them right out.
I think the word you're looking for is gregarious.
Yes, that's a perfect word for it.
We use clownfish regularly to cycle a tank. The traditional... cycle a tank has always been a damsel. But in the long run, who really wants a damsel in an aquarium? Because they turn into jerks.
Yeah.
Clownfish, most of the time, keep that calm demeanor, and they can be in the aquarium for a long time. And if you cycle correctly, you can keep them healthy and happy without really causing a risk to their life. So hopefully somebody will try to come up with an argument for me as to why a clownfish is not the best saltwater tank, but I'd love to hear those arguments because I think we can counter most of them.
Yeah, I never get the idea of why you would cycle a tank with a fish you don't want. What's your plan for that? Do you want it to die?
Fish are disposable, according to that attitude, and we just don't adopt that attitude here.
Right. To be fair, though, clownfish are just a specialized type of damsel.
That was coming up.
It was just the well done. Cool type of damsel.
True.
As long as I'm talking about this, I'm going to talk about it real quick. A lot of people ask me why clownfish are one of my favorite marine fish. And I'm like, because they're so weird. And they have such a weird lifestyle, but it is so successful for them. So they're a damsel that lives in an anemone. The lifespan of an average damsel is like 5-6 years in the wild. Life expectancy.
Mm-hmm.
Life expectancy of a clownfish is closer to 20. Like, they have specialized into a niche that allows them to live 4 times longer. And that's just weird to me because they're like, hey, this venomous thing, this is my home now.
Yeah. Like, this thing that eats my close cousins.
Yeah. Take that, Jimmy. Yeah.
And it's such a unique and interesting adaptation that in so many ways makes them perfect reef fish for us.
Yeah. They're used to just having a little nook in the reef and that's their home.
Mm-hmm.
It's talked about as quintessential on at least 3 different categories I can think of right at the top of my head. When you think of the quintessential aquarium saltwater fish, you think of the clownfish.
Mm-hmm.
When scientists talk about the quintessential symbiotic relationship, you don't talk about symbiotic relationships without talking about the relationship of an anemone and a clownfish. And then additionally, of course, the quintessential starfish, because of some movie... That's a clownfish as well.
Mm-hmm.
So let's touch real quick on clownfish and anemones in the aquarium, because that's another category that we'll do another podcast on anemones.
Right.
But we have to address anemones when we're talking about clownfish.
Clownfish are bulletproof. Anemones, not so much.
That's a great way to put it.
anemones are a glass house with rocks that can easily be thrown at them.
Yes. But the nice thing about clowns is that since they've been captive bred for so long, they don't, like, some of the captive strains don't even really recognize an anemone anymore. So they're not going to be freaked out if you don't have one.
The ancestral memory or instinct isn't as present. You know, you see all over forums, why are my clowns being hosted by my magnet scraper instead of the beautiful anemone I've been culturing for them. It's because they don't remember.
Well, Ben has this specific story. He was the one that told me why that is. Yes. So I'll let him tell this story.
Sure. So a good friend of mine was doing a clownfish breeding project in his basement, which for marine fish, breeding clownfish is a very, very possible thing to do. And he was producing way more clownfish than he knew what to do with. And he had his 220-gallon display tank. He had his reef aquarium set up and his brood stock for clownfish breeders in the basement and was producing, he was getting 50 to 100 baby clownfish successfully without a whole lot of knowledge in breeding clownfish. So he thought, hey, I've got all these clownfish that have just what we call settle out. A real brief description of what that means is clownfish go through a planktonic life stage. In other words, they are plankton for a while. When they quote-unquote settle out, what that means is they literally swim from the planktosphere, or being plankton, down to the bottom to find an anemone. So we had a couple of quarter to half inch size clownfish. Teeny little guys. They had all the full clownfish coloring, but they didn't. They were absolutely tiny. Little teeny guys.
Which and is adorable,
had,
by the way.
Adorable. He had pushed some 3/4 to 1 inch clownfish in the tank, maybe even a little over an inch long, and some of them had swam towards anemones, and some of them made their way towards anemones, and some of them just ignored anemones completely. When he took those 1/4 inch clownfish and put them in the tank, it was like a bullet being shot at an anemone. They went to that anemone like that was where they belonged. It was instinct that brought them, boom, immediately into that anemone. So what that suggests to me is exactly what Amy said. They forget. It's part of that initial settling instinct. Once they settle, that instinct goes away.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the evolutionary construct you can get from that is if a clownfish doesn't find an anemone in the wild, they don't live.
They get eaten.
They get eaten. There's no reason to maintain that memory over a long period of time because they don't have the opportunity to need that memory.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody out there who fishes, one of the best colors to use as a lure is bright orange, right? By the way, there's an adaptation for that, and there's a reason their clownfish are bright orange inside that hosting anemone. So if you could imagine a fish that doesn't swim very well, that doesn't immediately find its protective, obligatory symbiotic anemone in the wild, they don't get past that. So that's the juvenile clownfish story and why that memory is there and how cool that memory is.
And it's so funny with captive raised clowns. They don't necessarily know what they're supposed to do, but when they find it, it is very clear.
It's cool. Like, wait, what was that?
But they don't miss it. They don't need it. When they find it, they love it.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I use the term obligatory. That's a scientific distinction when you're talking about symbiotic relationships, because there are obligatory symbioses and non-obligatory symbioses. In the wild, the symbioses of a clown and an anemone we would call obligatory. In other words, their survival is dependent on it, both the anemone and the clown. In captivity, that relationship is not obligatory. That obligation has everything to do with predation, both from the anemone and from the clownfish. So clownfish need the anemone for protection just as much as an anemone needs a clownfish for protection. The blood drawn from a peculiar clownfish defending a host anemone in an aquarium and an unsuspecting person cleaning it is evidence of that.
Having been on the receiving end of it, yeah, those clownfish, even though you're 1,000 times bigger than them, they don't see that. They just see their home that they need to protect.
I kind of appreciate that about them. There's just something, cool. There's just something about a fish that size being like, I can take you.
Yeah.
Or I can piss you off enough and you leave me alone.
Yeah.
And it works.
Mm-hmm. But to be fair, absolutely, from their perspective, imagine just like once a week some dude just breaks in your house. Like, you're like, all right, I'm done with this.
I'm just going to smash stuff.
Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Yeah. You can see we have a ton of affection for these fish. Even though, like, clownfish are probably the only reef fish I can ever remember being bitten by, and yet It doesn't affect how much I love them at right. all. It just makes me love them more.
I have never met two clowns with the same personality. Like, the two downstairs in our display, those ones in particular, they're both pretty, they're thinkers, and they figure things out. Mm-hmm. I have never been tricked by a clownfish before until I met that.
They've got it all figured out.
How do they know to not attack your hand, but attack the soft tissue in between your fingers?
Oh. Yeah.
Or like right, like at the most sensitive part of your wrist or something like that.
They know where to head. What is it in clownfish genetics or biology that makes them know that? By the way, that is a rhetorical question. I don't know the answer
no
to
idea.
It, but that's an amazing thing about clownfish. So Charles, talk to me about clownfish genetics.
Okay. So to start off, I'm going to have to define a few things because I'm going to try and avoid these terms, but I don't think it's going to happen.
No, use big words. It makes it sound cool.
Okay. So if I say complex, I'm using it in the context of it's generally a group of species that are more closely related to each other.
Believed to be.
More closely related to each other based on morphology.
Okay. Good.
So that
good
causes some problems because...
Morphology meaning what it looks like, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Structures and whatever. The flip side is clades, which I'm much more comfortable with because clades are based off of genetics. This clade is related to each other based on genetics. And there's two ways of designating a clade. It's either monophyletic, which means that everything in the clade can be traced back to one common ancestor, or it's paraphyletic, which means it's not monophyletic. So, but a clade can be applied at any level. So like your grandfather and all of his children, that's a clade.
Okay.
Several species that have can trace back to one ancestor, that's a clade. An order with a single ancestor, that's a clade. As long as it's
excellent.
One group of organisms
mm-hmm.
that can be traced back to one ancestor, that's a clade.
I like it. I like it.
I might also say monospecific, which just means one species.
Mm-hmm. 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 And just out of curiosity, how are we, as in the human race, I should say, how are we gathering this information? How do we know where clownfish genetics come from?
So this is really cool. So the nice thing about fish is that their fins, at least with most species, their fins grow back. So genetic data is obtained by taking a little fin clip of a fish in the wild, letting it go, and then you can take that little fin clip, and they're like little slivers of fin, so it's not hurting it.
Right.
It's like a fingernail.
Yeah, and you can use that to obtain genetic data.
Just that little sliver.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
The perfect example to me, when you're distinguishing complex versus clade, the clades are... The distinction in the clades is a little bit newer science than the science that I came from when we were talking about the complexes that are clownfish. Anyone familiar with the McCulloch-eye clownfish, which is one of my favorite, one of my holy grail clownfish, and I think I got a source, by the way. The McCulloch-eye essentially looks like a black cinnamon clownfish, morphologically speaking. And it was then put into the complex of the cinnamons and the tomatoes and what's the one without a stripe? Ephippium?
Yes.
Without a stripe. No, I don't remember
it's
the common
Ephippium.
Name. Yeah, but I don't remember the common name of Ephippium.
I think it's literally called like a naked cinnamon.
That could be right. Could be right. So McCulloch-eye was put into the complex with those fish. The genetic studies that Charles had to ruin my... I mean, Charles taught me about my the difference between the complex and clade, put the McCulloch-eye clownfish into a different clade than the complex with which I had always associated it with.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I really love about, like, genetics is a pretty new thing. Like, a lot of this data is within the last 20 years, and it's upending a lot of things that we know, like, knew and have known for a long time, but...
Forget everything you thought you knew about clownfish.
Like, what we now know is, like, maroon clowns is probably three different species.
It's such an exciting time to be learning things.
Yeah. Okay, wait. So maroon clownfish, Primnus is the genus. Primnus biaculatus is the species we're all used to.
Yep.
Are you a lumper or a splitter when it comes to maroon clowns? So the gold stripe and the white stripe were always thought of as two color morphs of the same species. recently some of the splitters put them into two different genera, or two different species.
Yeah.
What do you think?
So I definitely think they are different species, but I also think that if we're looking at the genetic data the way it is shaping up now, Ocellaris and Pericula clowns should be moved in the Premnitz genus. Because
in really,
yeah,
that's because, very much lumping.
Because the Pericula, the Ocellaris, and the Premnitz, they actually lump together, and then all the Amphiprionas by themselves.
Hmm. What's the type species for clownfish for Amphiprion?
That I don't know. I would have to guess it. If I'm throwing out an honest guess,
yeah,
probably Clarkeye.
Could be interesting. More research should be done on that.
I'm gonna stop these guys here so that we can go back and try and explain what they're talking about. So lumping and splitting in terms of taxonomy, which is how we organize what species and genera and everything that they belong to, certain people want species split into as specific small groups as possible, and some of them want them to be categorized together. So that's what these two are arguing about.
It's discussing, Amy.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
And I'm definitely a splitter, but a big part of that is I just think that biodiversity matters. And if you can get as specific as possible, the more information you can get.
Yeah, we can't say if we only have one premise, that's enough.
Yeah.
Well, but the purpose of taxonomy is the study of the relationships of organisms and the distinction between those organisms. So if you're splitting them into more categories, you get to define what that category is in a more specific way.
Right.
So like with the gold stripes and the white stripes, they're not really color morphs of each other. They behave very differently. They have different lifestyles. They have different life, like what's the word I'm looking for? They mature at different rates. White stripe clowns are actually much more aggressive than gold stripes. If you pair them together, the white stripe will always turn into the female.
Interesting. Geographically, they're separated as well, correct?
Yeah. So the white stripe clowns probably could be split into two different species because there are two different phenotypes, and one of them you can find specific to the Philippines and the other one to Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands.
Okay. So the little teaser I talked about earlier with the clownfish that could go with the big predators, there was a store in Grand Rapids 25 years ago that had a 300-gallon display tank, which at that time, a 300-gallon display was like, wow, that's one of the biggest aquariums I've ever seen. And it was one of the biggest ones that I'd seen in a long time. In that tank, they had a lionfish, and they had a clown triggerfish, which is one of the most aggressive fish that I've ever experienced. They had one of the larger morays, and they had a panther grouper. And they had a clownfish in there that was just fine. It was about an 8-inch female maroon clown, a white-striped maroon clownfish. 8 inches long. It was the biggest maroon clown, the biggest clownfish that I have ever seen.
I would love to see one. I've never seen the maroon clown bigger than an Ocellaris clown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
they can get incredibly large.
I would love to see it.
And can be just fine in a tank with... The clown trigger in that tank was a 7-inch clown trigger. And it was afraid of the maroon clown.
I have teased with her that I'm like, maybe we need to just grow out a maroon clown downstairs until it's big enough to go in the shark tank.
And how many
tank.
Years would that take, Charles?
Probably 4 or 5.
Yeah. All right, get started then.
Yeah.
So anyways, I think we can start off with the Clarkeye clade because that one's pretty quick to go through. So funnily enough, the Clarkeye Clompilex had like 11 species. The Clarkeye clade has 2.
That makes sense.
So it's got Clarkeye and Trisynctis. The fun thing is that I'm pretty sure the genetic data is going to shake up in the next few years that what we now know as Clarkeye is probably 7 or 8 different species.
That makes sense.
There's a lot of genetic diversity going on there that I'm just like there's a lot of geological time happening here.
I think it's something interesting when you start talking about the taxonomy of color morphs. How many color morphs are there of a robin or a cardinal?
Right.
Right? In so many other organisms, they really all look the same. But when you look at something like a Clark's clown or Amphiprion ocellaris, which the black clown or Darwin's clown, there's a black version and an orange version. Incredibly different.
Okay, so as long as we're saying that, I have to tell the story of... So black Ocellaris clowns are definitely a different species. The scientific community is 100% on board on that. No one has taken the time to describe it.
That makes total sense.
Because they have... They take longer to mature than Ocellaris. They take closer to 4 years, whereas an orange Ocellaris takes about 18 months. They have different clutch sizes. They behave differently. And the black Ocellaris comes from a very specific region of northern Australia.
Darwin's Bay.
Yep.
That's the name Darwin's clownfish.
And that's it.
Yeah. They're going to be a different species at some point.
We were talking about...
Clark's clown.
Okay. So here, I guess I need to put in another definition. So I'm going to use the term polymorphism. Polymorphism is just a fancy way of saying there are multiple different genetic ways of doing the same thing. So hair color in humans is a polymorphism. There are different shades of it and whatnot, but generally, hair is a bad example for this, but generally polymorphisms behave differently than color morphs between species. So generally a polymorphism most of the time is limited to one gene. And so you won't really get a blending of color morphs, polymorphisms. You either have it or you don't.
Okay.
With color morphs between species or among species, they tend to blend. So like a maroon clown from Papua New Guinea is either a lightning maroon or it's not. That's a polymorphism.
Ah, it's not partially a lightning maroon.
Yeah.
It's not a little bit of lightning with white stripes.
Yep.
It's either got the lightning look or it's completely white stripes.
Yep.
I like it.
Or got the lightning gene or doesn't have it as in? Okay.
And then, so gold stripes and white stripes, if you breed them together, you basically get a washed out version of both species because there are multiple genes involved in those different colors. So when you start mixing them together, you get really weird combinations. So it's not a matter, so a hybrid gold stripe, white stripe is not...
Goldish.
It's not goldish. It just looks weird and kind of dumb in my opinion.
Does the striping, I've actually never seen the hybrid between the two. Does the striping affect the maroon color on the hybrid?
Yes. I've never seen one full size, but the younger ones I've seen, they all look kind of washed out. So the hybrid maroons, they look washed out, and then their gray pattern, like... their striping looks kind of gray instead of gold or white. So I'm like, wow, you took the worst of both species and just put it in one thing.
Right.
Kind of like as a kid when you used to mix some cool colors together, thinking you'd make even a cooler color and you just end up with brownish gray.
Yeah.
Anybody who's tried to throw 3 or 4 different colors of dwarf shrimp in their tank. End up with brown shrimp.
Yep.
So what we got started talking about polymorphism...
Yeah,
in Clark's clowns.
So a lot of the color morphs in Clark's clowns don't really behave like a polymorphism. They behave more like distinct colorations between species.
Okay. Thus the need to really split that up into a whole bunch of different species.
Yeah.
Yeah. Behaviorally, Clark's clowns, they aren't necessarily as aggressive as a maroon, but my experience with Clark's clowns is behaviorally they're going to be a little bit more like a damsel. They can be jerks.
They can be, and there's a specific reason for that. So Clark's clowns are one of the few clowns that can actually swim well.
They have a forked tail as opposed to a rounded tail.
Yep, and so in the wild, they actually behave very differently. So they're one of the few species that is not regulated to just their territory at their anemone. Most pairs will actually maintain multiple anemones that can be as far as like 100 meters apart.
Wow.
And you get some really weird stuff of that in the wild because of it. So like polygamous clowns for Clark's clowns is possible because if their anemones are far enough apart, a male might be able to pull off tending multiple nests.
He's got a family in every state.
Yeah. And like the females, they seem to be like, well, as long as he's tending both nests equally well, they seem to just put up with it.
Wow.
It's a little progressive.
Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe a little too progressive.
That's interesting. That's not how you normally think of clownfish. You think of clownfish as a male-female pair. I think most people do.
Yeah. But that's why I really like clownfish, because when you have like 30 species of them across arguably two or three oceans, depending on how you want to split it up, they have a lot of different strategies that they can work with within their niche of, I live in an anemone.
Yeah, how many different ways are there to do that?
Yeah. I think the next clade we can talk about real quick, and I will say real quick because this is not one I'm very familiar with, is the Epipium. The
Epipium, right?
Epipium, thank you.
I don't know these at all.
So that would be the...
Cinnamons,
oh. Tomatoes.
Okay.
Yep.
I will say that this species grouping is a great example of location matters when you're breeding. So for a long time, a lot of our commercial breeders thought they were working with, and I got to consult with my notes just to make sure I get this right, thought they were working with Rubrosinctus.
Mm-hmm.
And then new genetic data came out, and they said, no, what you actually have is Barberi. But we managed to track that because those breeders kept track of where they got their brood stock from.
Excellent.
Wow.
And very, very hardy. On the slightly more aggressive side.
It's super personable.
Super personable, yep.
That cinnamon clown we have, I think she knows people and has decided that she likes some people and doesn't like some others.
She's very threatening in her attacks, but it's a lot of show.
She hasn't gotten me yet.
She has gotten me a couple times.
Yeah. Well, you're the meanest too, or you're usually the one scraping the back of that tank.
Yeah, and that's her personal space.
I just feed her.
I feel like this next one, Ben will be able to talk about more because it's Pelimnus. And in that clade is also the Seabays.
Right. Seabays, which used to be in the Clark's complex.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The Pelimnus clowns were, as soon as we got those guys in, I fell in love with them. And it's five clownfish that we have in our little group. We started with six. One of them didn't last a week. The other five have been living together now for close to 2 years.
Yeah.
And seem to have this really cool little cohesive group with an obvious dominant female, an obvious dominant male, and three very clear drones that are definitely part of the group. It's a smallish tank that they're in, and they're getting along just fine. Really good, rich black color.
They're beautiful.
They're gorgeous.
I would love to see more people keeping a tank like that. I think a lot of people try to, like, oh, I really want a clownfish and anemone. So they try and put it in their mixed reef, and then it never really goes the way they want it to. But that anemone tank is so simple. It's just anemones and just saddleback clowns. And they're gorgeous. It's such a brightly colored tank. Their behaviors are so fascinating to watch. I'm never bored looking at that tank.
They work as a group, which getting Proculus or Ocelos to work as a group, it's kind of hit and miss, and usually a miss. Those guys.
Watching them all team up to get an anemone to move where they want it to go, they're so much fun.
I think one of the coolest displays, I feel like a lot of people, when they keep mixed reefs, they try to cram in as much as they can. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's just not the strategy I like to do. But I will also admit, one of the coolest displays I've ever seen, and this was like 20 years ago, was just 120 gallon with a big carpet anemone. It was a good like 15 inches across in a group of like six pink skunks.
Yeah.
And that was the entire tank.
Fantastic look.
It looked amazing.
Right. Yeah. Skunk would be another clown that's pretty easy to get to go as a group.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Both the pinks and the orange skunks.
Yeah. So the Indian clade I think is one that we can talk on a lot, but I don't think I will because the only one I've seen two of this clade in the...
What's the whole clade? Go through the list for me.
So, Bisinctus, Omanensis, Chatosensis, Latifasciatus, Nigrites, Elardi, the Cryptogaster, and Fusco caudatus.
I don't know any of those.
Yeah, so the lats are pretty rare, pretty hard to get. Elardis I've kept, and they have really, really flowy fins. Their pectoral fins are really, really big. Makes them really, really cool fish. I did not have that one for long. It was a wild-caught fish. It did okay. I would imagine if we could get them tank-raised, they probably would be a lot better. One of them you mentioned is, I believe, called the...
Bisinctus?
No, that one I've seen.
That one I've seen. And those ones are actually pretty reliable to the point where there's actually a color morph available. It's called the Spot Sync Test.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah, which also was in the Clark's complex. In fact, at first, the Spot Sanctus was called the Bonita I Clark or something like that.
It had a weird name.
Yeah, because they thought it was a Clark's. Turns out it was by Sanctus. No, the Negripus is the other one that I've seen before.
I've seen those.
Those were a little bit of a little bit more of a challenging clownfish to keep, and the ones that we got in were captive raised. Okay. Could have been the source, could have been the shipping, I don't know, but Negripus is another one that I'd like to get my hands on again.
The Negripus is one that kind of shocked me when it ended up in this clade, though, because a lot of the stuff in this clade used to be in the Clarki complex.
I believe Negripus used to be in Plymnus, though.
It used to be in the Skunk complex.
Okay.
I'm like, it looks kind of skunky. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have that like stripe down the side, but aside from that, it does look pretty skunky. But I don't think a lot of people, at least in this area, are keeping them. The Bisynctus is pretty cool. They're another one that they're a pretty strong swimmer. They behave very similarly to a Clarki.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're native to the Red Sea. So if you're like, I want a Red Sea biotope, I would say do like 100 gallon, do orchid dottybacks and Bisynctic clowns. They would be great to go.
They'd be a great tank.
The Australian clade is the Aikido Dinos and the McCulloch-i, and we've talked on those a lot.
McCulloch-i I have kept, and they were great. Getting those guys to pair up was challenging. They don't like each other right away.
I've heard that McCulloch-i's are harder than white striped maroons to get to pair.
Well, we will figure it out.
We'll find a way.
And the other one, one of my inspirations for where I am today was the store that used to be in town years ago called the Coral Reef. He's now in the Solomon Islands doing restoration ecology projects.
Wow.
But he was a cutting edge aquarium shop in the early 90s, possibly even late 80s, early 90s. And he had the, I'm not going to say the name right, the other ones in the...
Echinodinos.
Echinodinos. He had the Echinodinos. The Echinodinos species of clowns every once in a while. And they were gorgeous fish.
The next big clade is going to be the skunk clade. Uh-huh. And so there's the yellow skunks, which are the type species for the group. There's the pink skunks. There's a new species, Pacificus, which is actually, I think it split off from the yellow skunks. And then the orange skunks.
Okay.
The main thing you need to know about the skunk clowns is that they are absolutely adorable.
They are. I generally think pink skunks and orange skunks are like some of the cutest fish you can ever find.
Behaviorally there. And just like appearance-wise, they're so cute.
They just want to be loved.
Mm-hmm.
They're just mellow little fish that just let them go hide in their anemone and hang out and they'll be just fine.
I think they're the closest a clownfish gets to being shy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but in an engaging way where you still get to see them, not just hiding in the rocks all the time.
Right.
And they're probably the only one that we've gotten in here that I've really, and it could be just a maturity thing, but I've never seen any degree of aggression out of them towards each other or towards other fish.
The saddlebacks we have were the first time I've seen someone pull off a harem that wasn't skunks. Or they got really lucky with a group of Ocelaris.
Yeah. The only reason I didn't say them is because initially she did reject one member of the group.
Yep.
And that was it. Like,
he
once
did
she got,
step out of line.
Yeah, once she got that one out of the way, she was fine with everybody else.
Yeah. And I've seen people do some really weird, like with most Ocelaris that I've seen people actually pull it off, they threw in like 20 of them.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
I've seen people pull it off with skunks in numbers as low as 5 or 6.
Yeah, which is what we did with the saddlebacks.
Yeah. Yeah.
But even those big groups of Ocelaris, I think it's just that the lowest rung on the totem pole is better able to hide. It has nothing to do with they're less aggressive. It's just they're more distracted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We did not talk about, real quick, we should go into clownfish life stages, which... Granted, a lot of people are aware of what those stages are.
This is a good time to talk about it, though.
Yeah, but we've mentioned the female and we've mentioned the male, and how do we know that? Well, it's really obvious with the clownfish. The big, mean one's the girl.
Yes.
It is a terminal sex life cycle. There's a better term for
the sequential hermaphroditism.
Yes, there is sequential hermaphrodism, which means the terminal sex is a female, and that means every clownfish is born male.
The cool term for that is protandrous. Protandrous. Protoandrous.
Okay, there we go. In a group of clownfish, the two biggest, the two toughest, turn into the dominant pair, with the biggest one being the female, the second biggest one being the male, which means if you have a group of one, you have a female, because that's the toughest one in the group, the biggest one in the group. If the female dies, the mature male moves into the female slot, and one of the immature males has the opportunity then to move into the breeding male slot. If the male dies, one of the immatures has the opportunity to move up. It's one of the coolest studies that have been done on hormone-based sex determination, particularly stress hormone sex determination. So, just like with people, a stressed out clownfish produces the hormone cortisol. Cortisol is that hormone we produce when things are just going wrong, and it's a protective hormone. In clownfish, cortisol prevents the production of estrogen.
It's the other way around. So the female actually produces the most cortisol because she's spending the most energy maintaining her position. I can find you studies on that.
Find me the study, because my understanding of it is that she has to keep him stressed out so he continues to produce cortisol to prevent the production of estrogen to keep him male.
I can think of a specific study off the top of my head where invariably their dominant individual was the one with the most cortisol.
So what's going to prevent the male from becoming female? What hormone?
That is something that people actually don't have a strong answer for yet, because it's complicated. Because people are figuring out that most of what changes first actually isn't physiological, it's neurological. Which is really weird, because so I think it was in 2017, there was a new study that showed that clownfish, when they transition, their brain changes first, to the point where, like, if you extracted the brain and gave it to someone and said, is this a male or female brain? They would say, it's a female. And they're like, yeah, well, this fish has testes, so cool. It can take as short as like 2 weeks for that brain to neurologically rewire. It can take up to 3 years for the gonads to change and mature.
But I thought it was the production of cortisol causing the changes first in the brain.
Nope, apparently not.
We're going to have to find our comparative studies on this, because I don't read a lot of the scientific literature, but that is one that I did read. So more to come on that.
Well, that's what's amazing this hobby is that so much of it, it's like science and hobbyists working together to try and build towards new understanding of these creatures. So,
What we do know is that the female does need to poke the male every once in a while just to make sure that he doesn't turn into a female.
Yeah, the amount of calls I've gotten of, she won't leave him alone, I don't know what to do, and I just tell them, you gotta let her do her thing.
Let him work it out.
Because she's the boss.
Yep. For sure.
I know of one example, where the dominant male did not become the dominant female when the female died. I'll give you one guess which species it was.
A skunk.
It was a Clark's.
A Clark's?
Yeah. The dominant male just like, he must have really enjoyed just being that spot. Because
Smart move. That's the best position, I think. Because
the third in position before the female died jumped in front of him, and the male was just like, eh.
Yeah, no responsibility, but you get all the perks.
Just the one time.
I don't know about the perks. I mean, I've seen female clownfish keep their boys in line. That's a little, I don't know if I would want to be on the receiving end of that.
Yeah, but you do get the food first.
Yeah, that's true.
I was like, I think maroon clowns are the extreme example of the females treat their males as their greatest treasure and the most annoying thing on the planet. They're like, God help you if you try to get to her male, but also that's because only she can bully him.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's hard not to anthropomorphize clownfish just because they're so personable.
I think that a lot of people should anthropomorphize just a little bit more. I think we've gone to the point where it's like extremely like there is no emotion. I'm like, well, clearly they feel something.
Right.
It's probably not the same mm-hmm. emotions we feel. And in fact, they might feel emotions that we just don't have.
Yeah.
But I have definitely seen an Oscar that was clearly sad.
Yeah, I have definitely seen mad fish.
Yes. Yes.
No doubt. But
particularly clownfish.
I did save one clade for last.
All right.
This is the one I really want to delve into because it's a monospecific clade, and it's probably my favorite.
Monospecific meaning there's only one species in it.
Only one. So this is the Amphiprion Chrysopteris, which is the blue-striped clown.
Oh, yes. Of course we were going to go into those. Yeah, yeah.
It's probably four species of them.
Of course.
So that's when really cool. You noticed that all of these clades that I went through, this was not in any of them.
Mm-hmm.
All those color morphs bunched together in their own clade in genetic studies. Away from everyone.
Somebody's going to get their hands on that and split that up.
Yep.
Get their PhD by splitting that clade up.
So there are three major phenotypes that people see. There are yellow fins with like yellow tail, yellow fins. Those probably represent two different species because they are actually vastly far apart from each other.
Right.
So there's a group of yellowfin yellowtails in Polynesia, and then these ones actually have very thin blue stripes. They almost look like a blue stripe Bisynctus adult. Like they don't. Okay. Whereas the rest of the blue stripe clowns look more like a blue stripe clock eye.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll get other yellowfins in Fiji and in the Marianas Islands. Then the type coloration is white tail with yellow fins. So the true Chrysopteris is white tail.
That's a very different fish from a yellow tail and white tail. There's got to be really specific reasons for that.
Yeah.
Although you do see that in Emperor Angels, that the Indian Ocean variant has a white tail and the Pacific Ocean variant has a yellow tail. I wonder if we'll split those.
I would argue probably. I don't know enough about Emperor Angel specifically, right. But I will tell you in the Indian Ocean there's a loop, and in the Pacific Ocean there's a loop.
Yeah, makes sense. Makes sense.
And then the last, so I gotta say, the whitetail yellowfin variety, which is the type species, they're from Marshall Islands, Palau, etc. Then there's the black fins, which come from Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands. So not only are these color morphs geographically isolated, genetically they're pretty distant, but they still are closer to each other than they are to any other clownfish species.
Okay.
Well, I haven't seen them yet, but I've heard from you guys that the blue line clowns are one of the coolest ones in person. The pictures online can't possibly do them justice.
I will tell you, we're going to get in juveniles. They'll be ugly, but I'm probably taking them home because that's a species that I've never had and I want them really bad.
I'm excited to see them, even if they are ugly as juveniles.
But as adults, there are a few fish to me that you can keep in a reef tank that I'm like, that's more beautiful than that.
Yeah, that light blue color in pictures just doesn't transfer because everything looks light blue in a reef.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
Well, one of the biggest tails, if you look at one with a white tail, the tail is very clearly white, and it's
right.
Still got those blue hues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing yours when you get them.
Yeah.
We'll get them in soon.
So I feel like this is a great opportunity for me to get on my soapbox on like marine fish breeding, and it feels a little hypocritical because I haven't made that jump yet, but I would like to in the very near future.
You better be in the very near future. I would like to see it.
It's always been like kind of a something to aspire to for me, and I'm getting close to that point now. But anyways, I think marine fish breeding, or even just the way people buy marine fish, is kind of needs to shift a little bit. Like, we have all these different species of marine clowns to work with, and people are just going with color varieties of the same two. And I think that's kind of sad because we have these people who have worked very hard to figure out how to get broodstock and breed all these crazy species, and if there's not a source for that thing, if there's not somewhere for them to sell that thing, we could lose that species forever in the hobby, because in the very near future, clownfish are obligate anemone, and they're pretty sensitive, and global warming is not shaping up to be great for anemones. I am fully convinced that what we can breed in the hobby in the next 10 years is what we're going to have in the hobby indefinitely.
I think that's a good possibility.
So I think encouraging people to look at these other species. There's a clownfish for every tank. There's a, or even just captive bred fish in general.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
if you can get it captive bred, do it. Encourage those breeders to keep doing that innovation they're doing so that we can continue having crazy things in the hobby. Like, if people didn't figure out how to have yellow breed yellow tangs a few years ago, we probably wouldn't have them at all in the hobby now.
That's true. They're going to get shut down.
And we're already seeing the, you know, those trails of those yellow tangs becoming less available. And it's a great point that those fish that depend on specialist lifestyles or specialist habitat are the most threatened in the wild right now, particularly in our oceans.
Yeah.
So what does it take to breed a clownfish?
It's always been my understanding that part of the reason that Oscillaris and Percula are the most widely bred is because they're some of the easiest. But maybe I don't know what I'm talking about.
I don't think it has anything to do with easy. I think everybody wants that clownfish based on that movie.
Clark eyes are generally considered the easiest.
Okay.
The larvae of them are the most enthusiastic eaters.
And the largest.
And the largest. They have a fairly short larval stage, even compared to other clownfish. They're pretty adaptable. And your Clark's clowns are, if we've talked about how clownfish are basically bulletproof, like Clark's clowns, you have to do something egregious to mess up a Clark's clown.
Well, the friend that I talked about earlier that bred clowns, bred Oscillaris clowns, and if he could breed Oscillaris clowns, anybody could breed Oscillaris clowns. The first challenge with breeding clownfish is getting them to pair up, which is super easy. Now, there's some time involved in that because you do have to wait for the pair to mature, but most of the time, getting a pair of clownfish to breed up is much easier than it is with any of the other reef fish. They form that pair bond. They're going to stick together. You're going to know you have a pair. So obviously, they're step one with breeding clownfish.
Right.
Getting your pair. 18 months to 2 years for most clownfish is what it's going to take to get them mature enough to breed. So if your goal is breeding, start with larger clownfish because you can shorten that waiting period for getting them to mature.
What age do you think they're usually at roughly when we get clownfish as a generalization?
As we get juveniles, probably 6 to 9 months.
Okay. That's not too bad.
Mm-hmm.
Well, given that Oscillaris matures at like 18 months, whereas something like a black Oscillaris matures at like 3 or 4 years.
Right.
When you're getting them at 6 to 9 months, that's several years you could be waiting.
Right.
Yeah.
As long as you don't choose the wrong one, I should say.
Yes.
Yeah.
But usually they're going into a display anyway, so I would think that a lot of people who are wanting to breed have a pair in their display, and once they start showing signs of spawning, then it's time to move them into a separate breeder tank.
Or you don't even have to do that. I know a lot of people who have done it just by kind of leaning up like ceramic tiles around the anemone or wherever they're hosting.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll just be like, oh, whatever, and lay their eggs on that. And then you can just pull the eggs out that way.
So yeah. Rather than moving the fish, moving the eggs.
Yeah.
It's pretty common that if you move a pair of clownfish, you can flip that switch right off again. So you could have this pair of clownfish that's producing a batch of eggs every 2 to 3 weeks in your display tank. Move them into the tank where you have an easier time harvesting the eggs. And they shut off for a year and just don't breed again. So moving them can be a little bit risky. Sometimes you can move them and they can just keep on going. But there's some risk in moving them.
That's another call that I get a lot is, I'm so excited. My clownfish laid eggs. What do I do now? And I just usually say, there's nothing you can do because they're just going to hatch and get blown up into wherever. And all the other fish are going to eat that planktonic stage larva. So putting up something like a piece of slate for them to spawn on versus your live rock, that's a great idea. I've never heard that before, actually.
An inverted half a clay pot is what a lot of the clownfish breeders are going to use.
More vertically or horizontally?
Make it a cave. A little bit of a cave. They'll breed inside the cave. And a lot of clownfish breeders will tell you that it's best to have two of those. So you can have one of those half-clay pots in your broodstock tank when you see eggs at the right stage. Swap it out for the other one, and the clownfish don't necessarily behave as though anything changed other than the babies disappeared. The right stage to do that is as close to hatching day as possible.
Mm.
The parents are better at taking care of the eggs than we are.
Right.
Let them do that as long as possible. Once you remove those eggs, then you've got to get them through the planktonic stage, which is the most challenging for any fish that has a planktonic stage. Getting them through that planktonic stage of their life is the hardest part. When we unlock that with reef fish, most of the time we unlock breeding that fish.
And what's the difficulty then with the planktonic stage that people should watch out for?
Well, a big part of it is producing enough food, because like you're producing food for plankton. So traditionally, the way to do that was you had to culture live phytoplankton.
Rotifers.
And feed that to rotifers that you then fed to the fish.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of things.
But rotifers are not nutritionally complete. The phytoplankton is. So but the rotifers are just kind of a bag to get the phytoplankton into the fish.
Right.
And they trigger that feeding response. That movement of a rotifer triggers that feeding response.
I think I have to agree with, and I'm crediting Matt Pedersen because he's the one that said this to me. I do think that rotifers for a long time were a crutch that was holding us back in the marine hobby, because we've started figuring out how to culture new strains and species of copepods.
Much
and
better.
That's changing a lot of things, because copepods are a nutritionally complete food source, and there are certain species that will take inert algal paste, which removes the need to produce your own live phytoplankton. And Matt Pedersen did the math, and then I did the math just because I was hoping maybe I could poke holes at him when he came to the club. It's cheaper to buy those algal paste and feed them to your plankton than it is to buy salt to maintain phytoplankton.
Excellent.
Well, I think a lot of the people who are going to be interested in this part of the discussion are going to be our freshwater fish breeders who are thinking about what it would take to get, you know, their points in the aquarium club for marine fish or something like that.
Yeah.
And they're used to feeding their fish, their fry, or for a lot of freshwater fish, you can just use stuff like crushed flake or powdered fry foods. Are clownfish ever going to take that?
I do know people that once they get them to a certain stage, and I think it's around 11 to 12 days, it's not quite the settlement stage, because if I remember correctly, it's closer to like 20 days.
I thought settlement was in 11 to 12 days, but I guess it depends on the species.
I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
So to my understanding of it is that initial, I'm going to take a bite of something, that initial feeding response is triggered by movement.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it has to be done by something live. I don't know, and hopefully somebody out there can correct this, because I would love to find some fish out there that some of you are familiar with my fun relationship with live foods. Not a fan. Only because I don't.
That's why I do it downstairs.
That's what somebody else can do. Yes. What
yeah, I not love a fan about, is one way to put yeah. They're really easy to forget about.
Yeah. I love it when other people do live foods for me, so that I don't have to.
That's why but, we have Charles.
Exactly. Yeah. Getting that initial feeding response is one of the biggest hurdles to get through, and it's hard to do that without something that isn't moving around.
I do know that like you can wean them onto them faster than you could like gobies or something, though.
Gobies or dottybacks or some of the other relatively easy fish.
Sure. So breed. Maybe you have to suffer through providing live food, but not for that long.
Yeah.
Okay.
The nice thing about clownfish larvae, though, is that as far as anything we're breeding in the hobby right now on the marine side, they're definitely more durable.
Definitely.
Because I know a lot of hobbyist breeders having successfully raised them in just plain 10-gallon tanks.
Yeah.
And you can't do that with dottybacks or gobies.
Right.
You need like those black round tubs everyone's talking about.
Yeah. A good breeder setup with clownfish, two 20-gallon tanks and a 55-gallon tank. So a 20-gallon tank is your broodstock tank, a 20-gallon tank as your larval rearing tank, and a 20-gallon tank as your grow-out tank. Now, the larval rearing tank, one of the big things with clownfish is food concentration. When we're talking about the planktosphere, we're talking about an area where many creatures can swim through, open their mouth, and get enough food.
Like whale sharks.
Right. That's what happens in the planktosphere. That's how much food there is in a planktosphere. So clownfish are genetically designed to be able to find food about a half an inch away from themselves constantly as they're growing up. That's how much food is in that part of the world. So what a lot of the breeders will do is they'll take a 20-gallon tank and they'll put about 3 inches of water in it. And they'll put their newly hatched larvae in that 3 inches of water so they can concentrate it with food. And then slowly fill that up as the clownfish grow, given the opportunity then to easy water changes. Really, you're not taking out much water, you're just simply adding to it to dilute the pollution, because the solution to pollution is dilution. And then maintain that high density of food that those clownfish, those baby clownfish, need to be able to have food available to them almost at all times.
Well, that type of food density sounds like a water quality nightmare to me. How sensitive is that planktonic stained clownfish?
It's sensitive. There's the hard part right there. That's why it's not done every day. That's why it's not done like guppies.
Right, because you need to maintain that much food in the water and clean water, mm-hmm. which to me are just antithetical.
Yes, exactly. But not impossible. It's done. So once they, as they get through that planktonic stage, adding a gallon or two of water to that 20-gallon tank every single day is pretty much what you're doing.
The best strategy I've heard people use is they'll have like a gallon jug and they'll have a drip line into the tank so they're not like slowly trying to do it gently. It's just Perfect. Kind of doing it throughout the day.
Yeah. Or Sorry. One drip line with water and one drip line with food. Now remember, a lot of times what you're feeding these fish is live food.
Right.
And those live foods are designed to live in salt water. So you're not throwing dead stuff in, you're throwing live stuff in.
At least there's no rotting, there's just waste.
And that's yes. the nice thing about like copepods being used these days is that when you were growing rotifers, you were worried about how long the rotifer was in there because it was getting less and less nutritious as it's in right. there. You don't have that same problem with copepods.
Yep.
And are there enough copepods small enough that larval clownfish can take them?
Definitely.
The ones that I associate with are the big ones that you'll see on the glass in a reef tank or whatever. And those are pretty good sized.
There are like tens of thousands of species of copepods. They are generally considered the most prevalent form of plankton in the ocean.
But they're pretty easy to come by species at that size?
They're easier to do these days. That's like figuring out what species mm-hmm. to work with is something that people have only started figuring out in the last like 5 years.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. Mm-hmm.
So then as you fill up that larval tank, those fish will start to settle out. Pretty much when you start to see the stripes, it's time to move them down into the 55, and then you get to treat them a lot more like clownfish. You can feed them a flake food or a frozen food or a prepared food and grow them into a saleable size.
And how long does that full process take from hatching to settling?
Depend.
10 to 20 days, depending on species.
Well, that's not that bad.
No.
And then the grow-out phase is, depending on the species, like 6 to 8 months.
To me, mm-hmm. once they can take flake or pellet, then whatever, you're golden.
Then they start to get easy.
Then they're just fish.
Your losses should be less than 5% once they've settled out.
Wow. Okay. But because a yield of, just based on the oscillators we have down there, I mean, those are usually at least 100 fry per brood, right?
It should be 300 to 500 eggs every 2 to 4 weeks.
Yeah. So if you get 10% out of them, you've got a ton of clownfish.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
I love it. That's really interesting.
And that's one thing that I want to point out here is that since they breed so often and so prolifically, you get a lot of opportunities, if you fail, to retry.
And yes.
And I think that's something a lot of people overlook. Like, when I messed up an opportunity with my Betta Immaculata, it could be months before I'd get another try.
Right.
So for all of you out there that are worried about, but if you try again, you're killing those fish. Okay, so we're going to do a little ecological lesson here, and we're going to do some math here. Somebody write these down so you can do the math for me.
I'm not doing the math.
So in a balanced ecosystem, no one species is either increasing or decreasing in numbers.
Theoretically.
In a perfectly balanced ecosystem.
There will be ebbs and flows, but there will not be gradual increase or decrease of any species. What that means is, over the lifespan of a breeding pair, it need only replace itself, right? So let's take a breeding pair of Oscillaris clownfish, which mature at 18 months and can live for 20 years, possibly 25. We're going to say they're going to live for 20 years and 18 months to make the math nice and easy for Charles. So we've got 20 years of breeding.
20 years of breeding.
Right?
Got it.
And it's very likely that every 10 to 14 days, they're going to produce a batch. So we're going to say every 2 weeks. So that's 26 batches a year for 20 years. How many is that?
26.
26 times 20 is 520 batches.
520 batches. Times 3 to 500 eggs. So we'll go 400.
Times 400. That's 208,000 baby clownfish.
From one pair. And if they do more than have two of those grow up to breeding, to be able to breed, they have done more than they need to in their life. That means that a baby clownfish has a 1 in 104,000 chance of growing up to breeding size.
So if you're breeding them at home and you get a 2 out of 208,000 yield, you're probably doing better than Mother Nature.
Exactly. That's the point.
Yeah. That's the point. That's framing people need to think of. Yes. Like, oh, I only got three. I'm like, you're already doing better. Yeah. Like, like, you got to give yourself credit where credit is due there, buddy.
Yeah, you get one.
If you get 400 eggs and you only grow 10, you win.
Yeah.
Good job.
That's still a bappable fish.
You win. Yeah. Exactly. Yes. So that experimentation is okay.
And the clownfish won't notice the difference. That's natural to them. Their eggs are their eggs. They have no connection to something like a baby clownfish. That's competition.
As soon as they hatch and turn into Plensis Sphere, the parents no longer care. They don't miss them.
No. And if you don't want to breed and your clownfish are breeding, and you have a reef tank, don't worry. It's great coral food. Like,
tremendous food.
Like, just
very natural coral food.
Don't fret.
Yeah.
I did have one last point I wanted to make, and I think this is the time where it makes the most sense. I also want to say that I think some of the breeding in the hobby shouldn't be happening, though. Specifically when we're crossing species lines.
Yes. Because so there's a good segue into hybrids.
Yeah.
Which is something we're oh.
That's like our big, I don't know, the cloud overhead is the hybrid conversation.
The hybrid conversation.
Mentioning it.
But I will say that I don't think in the American hobby we have a true black Oscillaris anymore. And I don't think we have since 2004.
I've heard that statement before.
The tricky part is that in order to produce black snowflake clownfish, they bred black Oscillaris clowns with orange snowflake clowns.
Mm-hmm.
So now black snowflake clowns are a hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
It's a partially dominant gene, which means that most black Oscillaris in the hobby are probably carrying the snowflake gene, so they're probably hybrid.
So they're probably culls of trying to get black snowflakes.
Yep.
Interesting.
And if there comes a time where wild-caught clownfish are no longer available to us, then we just don't have those species anymore.
That's already a thing in the American hobby because no one wants to collect them from the wild. Darwin Bay is saltwater crocodile habitat. No one wants to go collect a fish.
And that's the only place that wild black clownfish are found, right?
Yes.
That's the only place.
Wild black Oscillaris.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, if you are interested in breeding clownfish, the book Clownfishes, A Guide to Their Captive Care, Breeding, and Natural History by Joyce Wilkerson is the go-to, I'm a hobbyist, I want to try this. It's basically an instruction manual for breeding clownfish. She does an amazing job spelling it out and making it seem pretty simple. It was written a number of years ago, so it doesn't go into some of the ease of some of the new foods that we have available. Reef nutrition is one of the great sources for some of the foods that are available for breeding clownfish.
Please talk to us about it because I would love to hear about that project.
Yes,
that's definitely something that we are going to be working on. So clownfish, gotta love them. If you don't love them, man, you haven't found the right one yet. There we go. That's a much nicer way of saying it than I just don't get ya.
If you don't like clownfish, I don't like you. Is that what you wanted to say?
Yeah.
Let us know your experiences. I'm sure so many of you out there have a place in your heart for clownfish in one way or another. One public aquarium that you've seen them at that you were really just taken aback by them or something like that, let us know what your experience has been as well.
Look for us on Facebook. Look for us on our YouTube channel. This is our podcast. Obviously, you could find this. There'll be hopefully more of these coming out every single week.
Don't forget to subscribe, send us some comments, send us some messages. Make sure to review it on iTunes or wherever you're listening to it.
If you disagree with what we are saying, please tell us. Let's open up the discussion. As you've noticed here in these podcasts, we do this because we like to talk about it. And a great way to talk about it is to gracefully disagree and talk through what those disagreements are. So please, if you disagree, let us know. Let's talk about it. And we will keep it civil as long as you do.
And if you have content that you want us to talk about, let us know. We're happy to talk about things people want to hear about.
Excellent. We prefer to, honestly.
Cool. And in the meantime, let's have lots of fun and keep your hands wet.